after I had a coffee with Francis, who is our guest, Francis Salol. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Try that again. I always forget to fade up the guest microphone. All right. So Salole or Salol?
Salol. You actually said it right first time, which is quite unusual.
Oh, good. Right. Yes. Mm. Okay. Welcome. And I'm excited about this.
Yeah, because, I'm excited too. I'm a little bit nervous.
That's good. That's good. I have this little thing of mine, which is when I was making a music video, and I said to the crew, if you're here and you feel slightly outside your comfort zone, then you're the right person for the job.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. Cool. I have a related story when people ask me about being a nurse, and particularly being a psych nurse. Mm-hmm. I said it's a really amazing job in that you get stretched right out to your peripheries as a person, and then a little right out to your comfort zone, and then a little bit further. And it's actually quite a wonderful thing to do if you can manage the anxiety and discomfort of it.
Yeah, yeah. That's learning, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Growing. So I just, I guess the first thing I wanted to say was you're away from Pakakariki for about 3 years. When did you come back to the village?
Well, we actually came back at the end of 2020.
Yep.
So
year and a half.
October we came back. Yep. So yeah, we've been back long enough to finally see what sort of fruit our trees make and actually taste it ourselves and the stuff in the garden and see things growing and flowering. So it's been quite lovely. Yeah.
Now, and I kind of had you just you've got a website, francissalol.com. And I put together a hyphen at describing you, Francis. You want to hear it?
Yeah.
Artist-animator-psych-nurse-musician-father-philosopher-PK-resident.
Wow.
I mean, I know there's more.
It's very generous. That's very generous. Thank you. Lots of dashes.
So we've got 22 minutes to talk about all of that.
We need 22 days.
So am I right that you coming back to the village was you were setting a new kind of agenda for your life going forward? Was there a specific plan? What was in your head and how have you how's it panning out?
The answer is no. I didn't have a specific plan. I always feel like I've got lots and lots of plans going on, but nothing sort of concrete and no sort of master plan per se. But one of the things that I've been enjoying and I've been thinking about from a philosophical point of view is this idea of having fresh eyes. Mm-hmm. And it relates to us as human beings, getting used to our vision gets used to what we see. Our ears actually get used to what we hear. And that's actually an evolutionary survival mechanism, otherwise be freaking out all the time. But also as sapiens, we get used to the way we do things. And when I was working full-time on the psych ward, we would have students come through. And I noticed that the students would be like, why do you do this? Or actually, did you notice that? And I thought, fresh eyes, mm-hmm. Like rather than say, oh, students, they're such a pain, we have to teach them everything, actually try and mine that mm-hmm. that idea that the fresh eyes have a real advantage. So when we moved down to Christchurch, I feel like I started a new job and my daughter started a new school and we were living in a new place and everything was new and had these fresh eyes. And coming back to Paikakariki, I was in my old studio, but I had really fresh eyes. I felt like I saw things differently. Going back and working on the psych ward, I feel like I had a kind of a freshness. And so I've been trying to think about ways that I can keep these fresh eyes and not get sort of jaded to the way we make assumptions about the way we do things. Mm. And as sapiens, maybe that's a great thing to try and do.
That's fantastic.
Did these fresh eyes mean that your art changed?
Yes.
A great deal.
I love that question. I really did, particularly one project that I did where I did lots and actually half a ton of fine art, I jokingly say. Mm-hmm. That's not an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. 100,000 paintings I did. And it was part of a project that I really thought was going to be something that I planned, and I put my hand up to the whole community and said, this is what I'm going to do, and I tried to do it, and I wasn't able to do it. And so I had an idea about what the art was, what it needed to be. And then I packed it all up in 49 boxes, each weighing 11 kgs, and stored it, went down to Christchurch. 3 years later, I came back, I took it all out of the boxes and I put it all on this long double table in my studio, and I did see it really differently. I saw it really – I saw the art in a really fresh way. Felt really proud because I think the art's really beautiful. But I also saw the project in a really fresh way.
Mm.
And that project, the art from that project, the purpose for it is kind of changing in a way that I think if I had stayed and just – if I didn't have the fresh eyes, it wouldn't have evolved in the way that it's sort of evolved.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds enormous. Can you explain the project a little?
The project was, I know the community knows about it because they helped me so much.
Mm. I think it deserves re-explaining.
It was called One in a Million, and it was what I was trying to do was like weave my nursing career and my art career together in a project that would make art and would do something in the community, to something positive for people who, and I don't really like this term, but people who experience mental illness. That mm-hmm. term I feel uncomfortable with, mm-hmm. but I'm going to say that. And the reason why I wanted to do that was because my own learning. You know, when I first started on the, I think psych nurses will recognize this, but when I started working on the ward, I remember that first day, you know, you walk out onto the floor and it's kind of a, it would be kind to say that there's a sort of a disquiet within uh-huh. yourself because it's an environment that is, it has a lot of humanity in lots of different ways, but it also has a lot of unpredictability and a lot of noise and a lot of chaos and a lot of other wonderful things, a lot of humor, but you have to get used to that environment and you have to relearn this is another gross simplification, but like what those people are actually like. And what you learn is over time that they're everybody. They're us. Mm-hmm. They're everybody. And I think the big thing after the years working there, the big thing was instead of being scary and dangerous, I found that the people who I took care of and I worked with and I nursed were actually really vulnerable in mm-hmm. the world,
mm-hmm.
heartbreakingly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to show that in a way that was very real. So the idea of the project was I was going to do 1 million paintings in a year, mm-hmm. and even the math was really interesting. I sort of got lost in the idea of the math.
You said one painting every 8 seconds, so is that 24/7?
There you go.
So Francis's.
Yes.
So how did you calculate one every 8 seconds? Is that if you didn't sleep? Or I haven't done the math.
I calculated that, because I did quite a lot of tests about how I would do that. And the great learning from the project is how do I make a painting that as an artist, and I've been an artist pretty much my whole life, how do I make a painting that I feel proud to hold up and for someone to buy?
Yeah.
You know, not just making it, anybody can make a painting in 10 seconds, but you might not be proud of it. And so I went about figuring out how I could do that. And I did. And there were a lot of things that I got wrong. But one of the things I got right was figuring out that I could actually do the painting part of it in about 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
It took us about 10 seconds per painting.
Mm-hmm.
And that part I got right. But what I didn't calculate was everything you do on that piece of paper requires lots of other work. Because I didn't do it all in one pass of 10 seconds. I had to mechanize it.
Yeah.
And do four passes at four different times.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd made a drying rack of 100, so I could put 100 pieces of paper in this drying rack, and every run was 1,000, so each slot was filled 10 times. Even to put them in and to take them out and reshuffle them in a stack,
yeah,
even that. Each but time. You had to do that so many times. And so that was one big blind spot that I had, was all the tiny myriad jobs in between the actual making of the art.
Yeah.
And the other blind spot I had, well, it wasn't really a blind spot, but I was pretty ignorant about how to run a massive project. And the project could only really work if I had the time to do all the media, to tell the story, to sell the paintings. And, of course, I didn't have time to do that because I was making 4,000, if my memory serves me well, 812 paintings a day, something like that.
Could you have had another pair of hands to have the media?
I had another pair of hands to help me actually do the painting.
Right.
But that was a very small part of it. A friend of mine said, after I finished the project, he said, "Well, look, there's not many people who would know how to do a million paintings a year." And I do feel like I learned I could do that. If I had a team and if it was funded, I know how I could do a million paintings in a year. I wouldn't want to, because actually 49 boxes of art is a lot to store and keep safe. And so
this was a project you undertook before you went down to Otatahi.
Yes, that's right. So I quit my nursing job.
Yeah.
And I think it's also worth saying that a lot of the energy and enthusiasm from that project came off the back of the ukulele orchestra's last tour of America that we did. So we did a fantastic tour of America. It was 9.5 weeks. I say fantastic, but because we were traveling around with my 2-year-old daughter and my wife and a nanny, it was actually a lot of work and a lot of stress. We did 40 gigs or something all through the States, but it was so wonderful and so energizing. And actually, we did financially quite well, and it was able to sort of financially help me boost the project. So it's sort of the energy came off the back of that tour, which I feel very grateful for.
That episode was not on your detailed in your bio on your website, by the way, Francis.
Sorry. Yeah. I still meet people and they go, "Oh, yeah, we saw a ukulele orchestra in Wellington in the town hall." I go, "Yeah, that was me." And they go, "Oh, we love that. Yeah, yeah, when are you guys going to play again?" And I have to disappoint them and say, "Well, we're not."
Yeah.
"Well, we don't have any plans." But. Yeah, nice.
Very good. So what is this, you know, one of your favourite, you know, expressions is less is more, you were telling me, which is kind of ironic, isn't it?
Man.
So tell us about that. I mean, you know, we love that idea of letting go of stuff.
Yes.
How are you, you know, how are you kind of living up to that lofty, you know, ambition?
Well, to be honest, I would say that I'm not living up to it, but I'm I think it's an idea that is really interesting. I think it's an idea that we're going to need to embrace in the future if we want to survive as sapiens, without getting too serious about it. But it's an idea that really intrigues me, because we all have to have some sort of relationship with technology, some sort of relationship with social media, some sort of relationship with, you know, the stuff that gets fed to us. My daughter's, you know, she's at the school here and she's just turned 8, and she, can I watch something, can I watch something, can I watch something, you know? And so the less is more, I think, is an idea that has lots of interest for me, because it's not just about the fact that we have evolved as these very, very efficient biological machines that can actually survive, and not just survive, but actually thrive on very, very little.
Mm-hmm.
And now we can actually, we don't have to deal with that, because we can eat so much that it's kind of working against us. But also in terms of our brain, in terms of what our amazing brain can do, I also believe that we've evolved to, you know, sit and stare into a fire and actually come up with stories and solve problems and have imagination and evolve our memory and all these kind of things with very, very little. And I say very little, but to stare in front of a fire, if you love pattern and you love complexity and you love self-organizing,
there's nothing better, is
matter,
there?
It's really? Not. It's not. Yeah. It's not less.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, in terms of like sitting down and watching some chaotic thing on television. Not only that, but having that device constantly telling you there's more and there's more and there's more and there's more. So I think the idea of less is more is quite a vast idea. And I like the idea of us embracing that, so that we can, we can use how we've evolved, the efficiency of how we've evolved, and this exquisite suite of senses that we have that are so exquisite. But instead of bombarding it, mm-hmm. we can give it less so that it can do more, literally. Mm-hmm. The other side of the coin, I think, is that we're also hardwired to want more because of our chemical systems, our neurochemistry. You know, we're almost chemically evolved to become addicted to things because our brain does want more. That's how we evolved. Mm. So we're kind of hardwired to want more, and mm-hmm. at the moment it's sort of working against us in certain in certain arenas. And you know, the fact that these vast companies know that and are actively trying to mine our attention is quite disturbing to me, particularly when you see the little ones and how vulnerable they are.
Absolutely.
To that sort of visual noise, you know, that sort of auditory candy crack,
absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely, yeah. I think another concept, you know, we were talking about, which is a beautiful concept, is relating to what you're saying, is this idea of having this principle and then applying it in the real world. And the phrase you came up with was negotiating alignment, you know, which is this idea that we do this with everything, every conversation and every contract, you know. Not at all. I mean, in other words, it's the negotiation part is kind of taking that principle. And then how do we interlock with the real world? Because otherwise you're kind of speaking into a vacuum, you know, and it becomes a – it has to be practical. Is that right?
I think negotiating alignment is a term that to me is really lovely. And a social worker friend of mine mentioned that term because I was talking to him about how I was struggling with my older brother. We're very, very, very close, but there's certain areas where we clash. And I said to him, why is it so important to me? Like, why do I get so upset? Or why do I need to talk to him endlessly he says, as sapiens, we negotiate alignment. And it suddenly clicked. It's like, that's why I get upset when I can't negotiate alignment with him. And I also think, you know, I love talking about us as sapiens, and I love talking about our evolution. Mm-hmm. And as sapiens, we negotiate alignment with each other, and I think we always have. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's part of our ancient past. You know, you meet someone, you need to know, am I safe?
For sure.
Basically, you know, am I safe? And that's, I think that's where negotiating alignment comes from. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, we're so complex, you know, our culture is so complex that negotiating alignment looks like me sitting here with you and having this amazing conversation. The other reason why it really appeals to me as a model is from a psychiatric nursing point of view.
Absolutely.
If you want to be effective for someone who's in a sort of crisis and they're asking for your help, or even if they're not asking for your help, but you've been paid to give them help, if you can negotiate alignment, you can be more effective. That's what I believe.
Sure.
So it helps me. The idea of negotiating alignment is a lovely idea that helps me kind of visualize or somehow imagine an idea of what we're actually doing. Mm. How can I negotiate alignment better? Mm. And it also links with the other concept which I love at the moment, which is the Venn and the diagram.
I was going to bring that up.
Go on, then.
Well, I was going to say that you drew a Venn diagram. We talked about it. You sent me a Venn diagram of all the broad topics we were going to talk about and the intersection of them.
Yeah.
And so that was – and one thing I was going to – like one thing I added to your diagram was this was the word patience. It was kind of like you're an animator by trade, many times in your career. And that requires a lot of patience.
Oh, my gosh.
And then, you know, there's that terrible pun of patience and patience,
You
know, when you're in the psych ward.
Yeah.
But it's the same kind of thing. It's do you consider yourself a patient person? Answers. If, you know, hop back to the Venn diagram if you want.
To be really honest, I really – In some ways I can be patient. I mean, animation is actually excruciatingly tedious. I mean, as much as I love it.
I don't doubt it.
But it is quite magical.
Yeah.
I mean, when you move something around and you press play and you see it literally come to life, you're kind of hooked. It's kind of magic about it. Yeah. That suspension of disbelief, which is another term I love. Anybody who's watched Wallace and Gromit, you know, it can be magic.
But does the reward equal the effort?
sometimes not. I mean, it depends. You know, on a project like Kitty and Lou, which is probably, if I had to say, my favourite. It's such a beautiful project to work on. Mm. There's such beautiful little films.
Isn't that nice that you spent 3 years of your life doing something that you love and you're proud
of? I was very, very, very lucky. Cool. And I'm still doing that. Next Thursday I'm going down to do another couple of weeks.
I don't know the show, but is it a web series or is it on network television? Tell me a little bit about
that.
It's
on TVNZ, and it's so beautiful because everybody who's involved in it are just, I think they're just the top of the top. It's written by Harry Sinclair and Don McGlashan.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's got a Front Lawn vibe about it.
Wow.
Is it for children?
Yes. It's for little ones, so 0 to 5.
Yeah.
But I've got a friend who's in her 60s and she just binge watches it because it's got lots of depth.
Oh, that's cool.
Is it on during the day?
It's on TVNZ. Yeah, and you can watch all the, I think there's three seasons up there now. Yeah. And it's really beautiful. So Harry's such a clever writer, and he's written these beautiful little 5-minute stories for children. But I think he, like me, when you have a child and you watch the things that they want to watch, this, even the good ones, it's so fast and loud and frenetic and flurried, So he wanted to make something that was just a bit more slow, a bit more emotionally intelligent, and left a lot of space and a lot of air. So they're the two writers. And then every episode there's a beautiful song, and Don writes the music for that. And then Anthony Elworthy is the animation director, and he's one of the best. Wow. You know, he's one of the best animators in the world. He's just come back from animating Pinocchio in the States. He's one of the top. So everybody involved in it is just...
Yeah.
It's just
so you animate it yourself.
There's six animators.
Oh,
and there's some that have come and gone. We've had some of the best animators from Wallace and Gromit come over from Bristol. And so it takes us six animators about 2 weeks to... Yeah. 2.5 weeks to do a show, but the beauty of it, it's plasticine.
Oh, cool.
And you hardly ever get to animate.
So you're going down for season 4. How long will you be
away for? I'm going down to finish season 3. I'm just down for 2 weeks.
Oh, good. Yeah. Okay, right. Awesome. Thought we were losing you. So look, we're running out of time, so I just want you to talk about the exhibition that's coming up on the 8th of July at the Paikokoriki Arts Studios.
No, the exhibition is at actually Opunake.
Opunake, right?
Opunake, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's at a gallery called Out of the Blue Gallery. It's Viv Davies Gallery. It's a textile gallery.
Right.
But she loves the fact that one thing I'm doing right now is I'm weaving I'm doing weavings with previous paintings, actually, from the One in a Million project. I'm weaving them together. Right. So it's going to be exhibition of the weavings.
Yes. Hey, look, we've run out of time. Thank you so much
Thank you.
For coming in, Francis.
All right.
Yeah, we're actually